RadioCompany.com.
So I, the reason I'm calling you to do this, I had suggested to Mary McKenzie, I love to interview people, I like to hear their stories, and I had suggested to Mary McKenzie a number of people that I would, you know, love to kind of hear more about, and I thought of you.
Okay.
And I thought of you for a number of reasons. One, I'm excited to learn kind of more about Play in the Wild and other activities that you've been up to, and so I want to maybe just start with Play in the Wild. Tell us kind of about the inspiration for that.
Wow, Play in the Wild. Gosh, I've been running summer camps for the last 20 years and taking kids into the wilderness. So it seemed pretty inevitable to combine my love for teaching people about nonviolence and nonviolent communication and then the skills of being in the wild. So the idea really took hold about 3 years ago when I teamed up with a woman named Melanie Whitman up in Canada, and we decided we wanted to do a canoeing trek up in Canada. And getting kids out into the wild, getting teens out of their, I guess, normal placement, as you, I'm not really sure how to term it, out of their normal context, and then placing them in a situation where, as a community, they're going to need to develop skills to communicate with one another, not only just to get meals made, but to actually kind of survive situations, you know, depending on weather, depending on how far we hike back into the wilderness, and the fact that we just take in the food we carry on our back. So we are in definitely a situation where communication skills are just innately brought up no matter what we're doing. So it's a great place to immediately practice everything that they're learning about nonviolent communication.
Wow. So what has there been, like, some specific highlights of learnings that kids have sent you testimonials about, or what's happened for them since participating?
Yeah, there's this one girl really stands out in my mind. I'll call her Mel. She was from Canada, and she was a student that actually received a scholarship one summer to come with us, and she'd been in a foster care situation, and she was a teen, and it was really quite interesting because she arrived with her cigarettes, and the smoking laws in Canada are slightly different than they are in North America, and so I was a little taken back by the age of the student and then her arriving expecting that she'd be able to smoke. And it was really interesting. As a community, we sat down and put all the needs on the table and expressed, and kids expressed needs around health, kids expressed needs around connection and how they wouldn't feel as free to connect while she's having a cigarette. So it was really interesting. We got to a group agreement where she would only have 6 cigarettes a day and be 200 yards away from anybody when she would take the cigarette. But then we got to the part of the trek where it was the vision quest, where the students go out. Sometimes they go out overnight for a full 24 hours alone, but for this particular trek, the students went out for an 8-hour period where they were alone in their small area, whether it was a rock that overlooked the water or sitting under a tree to be with themselves for that time period. And so when she was about to go out on her quest, I went up to her and I self-expressed and I said, you know, I have to admit some scary honesty that I can't imagine you going out on this vision quest and then sitting out there smoking. How would you feel if I hold your cigarettes for you and you try this 8 hours without a smoke? And she said, okay, I'm totally willing. So she went out for a vision quest, and, you know, it was gone all day. All the kids came back together. We had our ceremony to end the vision quest, and we had our feast at the end of the fasting because they fast during that period as well. And then right at the end of dinner, she came up to me, and she said, can I get my smokes back? And it was a great moment for me because I had to really check myself. Wow, here I could play power over and just not give them back to her. And I really just, put the cigarettes in my hand, and I said, I have to say, I feel nauseous handing these back to you because I'm not really sure how they're serving you. Would you be willing, when you go light this up, would you come back and report to me what needs of yours are really met by inhaling this tobacco. And so she left, and I swear, as soon as she left, she was back, and she handed me the cigarettes. And she said, you know, I don't think I need them for the rest of the trek. I really connected to my need for belonging, and I'd rather be with the group right now. And so one of the follow-ups we got on this girl actually a whole year later was she went back to her group home, and she started, you know, working with the kids that were there. She, in the words of one of the caregivers of that group home, said she became a model citizen for the rest of the kids, and she kind of became a group leader. And from what we heard, she didn't smoke again.
Wow. That's powerful.
Yeah. I love how fast people between the ages of 12 and 18 move through this work and connect and adopt the language and then just apply it. It blows my mind. It's
wow.
Great learning for me constantly.
Yeah. So where are you doing these Play in the Wilds? What's happening next and where?
Well, last year we expanded and we went all the way to Australia, and we did one in Perth, Australia, and that was extremely successful. So they would really like to do another one. And we went up to Alaska and to Denali State Park this last year as well. And so this year, because of the economy and things, we're actually scaling back a little bit. We're looking at doing one in Albuquerque or around the Albuquerque area in New Mexico. William Poner is working with a lot of teens in that area, so it just seems like a really rich area to do it in. We're probably going to plan for Australia again in 2010, and then we're looking at possibly doing one here in the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina, kind of close to my new home.
So parents are putting a great deal of trust in you to do the Vision Quest and to take their teens. Is there anything that they're wanting to know about you before they're willing to entrust you with their kids?
It's a great question, because usually I get to have a conversation with parents or caregivers before the teens are entrusted to us, and I think they want to know kids are safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it really is a safe environment, and it's such a unique environment too, because we really are setting up a community where everybody's voice is equal. But we're also not willing to have anyone's preferences put anybody in danger. So it's this really tricky balance of creating kind of a micro-society that is nonviolent and then making sure everybody stays safe, free from harm, and is really included. And so, yeah, I think it's different for each parent. What really is alive in them. One of the things we're looking forward to in the future to create, Joe Field, who was our organizer over in Western Australia, she does a lot of work in NBC there, particularly with parents. She has a really wonderful parenting program. And so we've been talking about how maybe if we expanded, what we'd really love to do is have Joe work with caregivers and parents in order to receive the kids back. Because the kids go through such a transformative process. That's been the area where we feel we want to do a little bit more expansion and work on, is so that these kids can be received back and have an easeful integration process back into home.
I would imagine that would be really important, that reentry.
Yeah.
What got you so excited about that particular population?
Wow. I think, you know, it probably had a lot to do with the fact that when I was a teen, interestingly enough, when I was a teen, the only two teachers that really connected to me were teachers that I had for the outdoor education elective that we had at my high school. And they were teachers that really called me on my stuff, didn't let me lie to them. And that was a real inspiration around the wilderness aspect for me. I ended up training search and rescue dogs in my early 20s and being really involved in the wilderness aspect. And then when I got into education, I really saw the population of 12 to 18 years old being this population that a lot of folks have a lot of enemy images around, including ones who want to go help them, kind of create them to be separate or apart from the rest of everything, or the rest of that it's such a unique time frame. And so for me, I wanted to be able to have these youth of this age group be able to connect with adults that didn't really have any projections or prejudgments or any kind of imaging of them, positive or negative, that they would just have an opportunity to just be able to express themselves and have a place, either whether it's healing their own pain of whatever their personal situations are or their frustrations with society in general, giving them this space of freedom with utilizing nonviolent communication has created real trust with this age group, with the people that I've trained to work with them or even with myself.
Mm. And how did you come upon NVC? Because I know you also had Temba School, and I'm guessing there were some outdoor components with that as well.
Yeah, we had every Thursday or Wednesday was Wild Day, and the whole day was outside. Wow, NVC came into my life actually a year before I started the Temba School. And quite literally, I was sitting on a friend's sofa, and I was actually contemplating something that had happened to me the year before, because I had been in a junior high in Marin County and had been at a teacher's meeting where we had had an emergency teacher's meeting because a gun had been discovered in the locker of a 10-year-old.
Mm.
And so, of course, the decision to remove all the lockers happened pretty quickly. And then there was the discussion about how do we deal with children's behaviors. And one of the things that came up in that discussion was they wanted to create a grading system for children's behaviors and display it on a wall in front of the school or in front of the classroom so that if a child wasn't acting kind, they could get a grade of a D or an F, and it would be displayed for everybody. And I spoke up in that meeting and I said, gosh, I'm a little worried about naming a child to be a D or a B or an F based on their behavior of kindness, which seems to me kind of vague. And how do we really measure this? And I would imagine the kids that are coming in with certain behaviors that we're wanting to change already walk into school maybe judging themselves. And so I don't know that I would want to add to that. And in that particular meeting, I didn't have enough information or languaging, and I was kind of contemplating and thinking about that when I was sitting on the couch, and I had actually said to myself, wow, I really need a language or some kind of clear communication device around nonviolence. And I look up at the bookshelf, and there's this book, this little blue book, and on the edge of it says nonviolent communication. And I literally was, duh. And I pulled it off the shelf, and quite literally the very first page I ever opened to in Marshall's book was Labels Block Compassion.
Wow.
And so it was amazing to just go, this is what I wish I had had in that meeting. And then, so I asked my friend where she got the book, and she said, oh, I think our other friend gave it to us. I haven't really had a chance to look at it myself. So I called this other friend, and he happened to say, oh, the guy who wrote the book's going to be in town, which was San Francisco, next week. And so within a week, I got to go see Marshall do an intro, and of course anybody who plays guitar, sings silly songs, and plays with puppets gets my vote. So that was my introduction to nonviolent communication. And then, you know, months later, I opened my school, and what was really quite auspicious and wonderful for me was it was kind of around the same time Bay NVC was forming, so I had a plethora of people to pull on. Julie Green was, you know, really big as one of my mentors in NVC, and she helped me out quite a bit. In fact, the first several years of my school, I used to just say, will you come train the parents and the teachers, please? And she would come and work with the parents and teachers, and at that time, Marshall was actually coming through San Francisco quite a bit, so anybody who was hired onto my school was requested to go do a training with Marshall when he came through town. And so we had quite, and I think we even had a two-day with Inball years later. So it was just, you know, it was a really dynamic place to start a school like this that was really having a paradigm with no punishment reward, You know, the kids used to love it when new kids would come to school. They'd go, you don't get in trouble here, but you have to be responsible for all your behavior. You know, that was what they'd tell each other. But there was this excitement about taking that responsibility for behavior and then being in a place free from getting in trouble.
Mm, wow. Now, so you were had already planned on starting the school, and then you ran into NBC before you did.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah, I had been working about 6 years on my philosophy because I had been in the public school system. My first teaching experience was when I was 18 in a Montessori school system in Kansas City. And I had kind of studied Rudolf Steiner and checked out Waldorf. And nothing was quite fully resonating with me completely until I found a woman named Gloria Cooper in Berkeley who was running the New Age Academy. And she was really integrating music and mathematics and several different philosophies, but I was still looking for a paradigm that didn't engage right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was where I really leaned into the tenets of nonviolence and everything I'd studied in all my peace school studies with Dr. King and with Mahatma Gandhi, who actually wrote quite a bit on education and looking at how to educate the whole person so that as they grow, they can be in contact with their most passionate qualities that would be of most service to their society so that we could create productive, peaceful societies. So I really based my philosophy on the tenets of nonviolence, and it was finding nonviolent communication that kind of created this bridge of, oh, I have this tangible, pragmatic process that people can read about in this book, and it also housed the new consciousness that I was really trying to seek and create with basing the philosophy on the tenets of nonviolence.
So where did that come from in you? I mean, was there something in your growing up or something that was really connected to the whole sense of nonviolence?
Wow. You're talking to someone who at 10 years old felt great relief when she watched Nixon resign. So I've been political a very long time, social activist for a very long time. Gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's just something in me that has felt war is obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my love of kids and animals have often taken me to careers that got me close with them, and then, you know, really getting into the public school system and then seeing the behaviors that were arising on the school playgrounds, which felt to me just like mimicking what was happening in the bigger world between countries, that was where I thought, wow, I really want to test the ground and see if it's possible to create a daily experience for children that's completely different. That offers them the possibility to practice peace or productive living together. And where does it come from inside me? I don't know if I'm really clear, you know. I mean, I had, you know, pretty intense childhood and upbringing myself and have witnessed quite a bit in the world and just really want beings to be free of suffering and happy. You know, just actually, it's like really simple. I just want beings to be happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so was that a springboard, that philosophy for the rest of what you did, the Play in the Wild? Was that after Temba School, just chronologically?
Yeah, Play in the Wild came up after, well, it was actually a few years there was happening simultaneously as the school. I just closed the school last June, so that I can do more trainings and be free to travel and work outside the classroom. But I had been running Temba summer camps. So basically, Temba summer camps morphed into Play in the Wild. So I'd been doing those kinds of summer camps for the entire time I'd been doing Temba and before.
Mm-hmm. And Temba, I know that you're now moving, you've moved east. So Temba School, is it still in existence with new ownership or new people running it? Or how what happened to that?
Yeah, the way we completed was we closed the nonprofit, and then the parent body that was in existence at the time kind of decided to go their own ways. So there was a group of parents that wanted to continue a collective and do it homeschooling style. So they adopted some of the Temba philosophy, and they're kind of co-creating their own thing now. And then there was a group of parents that wanted to create a charter school through the public system. So they actually took some of the Temba philosophy and now are doing a cooperative charter school. So it's kind of interesting. It kind of spawned into two different groups, which is great. More outreach.
Yeah, and Temba, what does the word mean?
The word actually means hope in Zulu. It was a word that came to me actually when I was about 14 years old. My sister gave me a book called The Lions of Tembavati, and there was a white lion born actually the year before I was born in South Africa, and the people tracking it named it Temba in hope that more white lions would return. White lion is a bit to the South Africans how the white buffalo is to North Americans. And I chose it as a symbol, so white lion was our symbol for the school, and chose Temba because I was really hoping for something to return. I didn't feel like I was starting something so brand new. You know, Mahatma Gandhi said nonviolence is as old as the hills.
Right.
You know, so I was hoping for something to return through, you know, some new ideas. And it was really fun when I got to go the second year of Temba. I had a chance to travel with a family from Temba to South Africa to attend the Parliament of World Religions and to take nonviolent communication to the first Waldorf school in McGregor Village in South Africa. And it was really fun because when I'd say the Temba school, they'd go, oh, the white lions. It was really great. Everybody knew what it meant.
Wow. You've traveled a lot. I mean, you've been to Afghanistan, brought up NBC there. You've been to Australia. What? Give me some highlights of some of the trips that you've taken.
Oh, my gosh. There's... Wow, there's so many.
So give me one from Afghanistan. What prompted that trip and what happened there?
Well, Afghanistan, I think what prompted that trip was when the request came through the CNBC network, I was really excited to respond because I really wanted human contact and I really wanted Americans to arrive in Afghanistan with other tools and other possibilities, and let Afghans know face-to-face that there were Americans who cared deeply about what was happening in their country. And working with Han from the Bureau of Reconstruction and Development was really wonderful, and we had a whole day with children, 41 children, and we had a five-day training for adults. And I would say the highlight, one of the big highlights, was at the end of the day for children. This 13-year-old came up to me who knew some English because she had been a refugee in Pakistan for a while. And she came up at the end of the day to thank me personally, and she shared how inspired she was. And then she shared with me, sorry, I'm going to start crying. She shared with me, "You're so lucky you get to do what you love." And we had this wonderful moment of eye contact and shaking hands, and it was just this poignant moment of just making such deep connection to a young woman in Afghanistan and hearing she was inspired by what we brought.
Yeah. And I'm guessing some real grieving that maybe she's not able to move forward with what she would like to be doing right now.
Yeah, some definitely touching the sadness that things aren't all quite in place for her to jump on exactly what her passion is.
Yeah.
And knowing she, in particular, probably has more possibility than some of the other kids that we had a chance to work with, like the street kids that we had a chance to work with.
Yeah.
And then one of the women, we actually had one of the women in our five-day adult training was the head of the Ministry of Women's Affairs for Afghanistan, and she'd brought some of her staff, and we were teaching restoration circles and some basic nonviolent communication skills. And at the end of our training, her gratitude to us was, you know, all my life my religion has told me that I need to forgive. You know, that I have to forgive. And at the end of this training, I finally feel like I know how to forgive.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. What a funny story would be from South Africa. I didn't realize how many, you know, how much I say the word dude. And I was working with this sixth grade form at the Waldorf school, and was working with them actually because their teacher was going to quit, because in Waldorf schools teachers stay with their group of kids K through 8. They stay every year with them.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in her sixth year, and this group had developed quite a few habits of conflict with each other. And she was really frustrated and going to quit. And so I came in to, you know, help do some conflict resolution. And we talked about different levels of communicating and blame and releasing our prejudgments of each other. And it was really funny. After the class, one of the kids came up to me and said, "You said dude 42 times. Mm-hmm. And I go, "You're kidding me." He goes, "You are from California." But it was, that was a really wonderful experience, too, because the teacher of that class went back in after I'd worked with her group, and she taught her math class, and she came out, and she said that was the most fun she's had in years with her group, and she didn't want to quit.
Wow.
And so I ended up giving her email support and shared with her some ways to set up group agreements in the classroom, and so I gave her email support through the end of that school year and then into the beginning of the next school year. And she went on to continue with her group until they graduated.
Amazing. And where else have your travels taken you? You said South Africa, Afghanistan. You talked a bit about Australia, playing the wild there.
I had a chance to go to Argentina and work in Buenos Aires in schools there for really 2 solid months. I was in and out for about 4 months and had a chance to work with teachers and educators and kids there. And gosh, one story that sticks out was Julian Lichtman was my translator and my co-facilitator for this one group. We were working with about 40 educators in this school, and there was a conversation happening between, we were doing a role play between a parent and a teacher. And so they did it all in Spanish. And Julian was getting ready to translate. And I said, "No translation needed." And I said, "So I'm guessing this is at the point where," and I pointed to the one who was role playing the parent, "you're feeling really frustrated because you would really like to be seen for how much you're offering your child." And then I looked at the teacher and I said, "I'm guessing this is the point of the conversation where you're feeling really frustrated because you'd really like to be acknowledged and seen for how much you're offering the child." And then Julian translated that into Spanish for them, and they both started laughing, like, "How did you know?" And I said, "That's the interesting thing about empathy and connection is I think it can, you don't even have to translate the language. It seems fairly similar language to language that I travel in, you know, where needs seem to be so universal." I mean, I think that's the thing through all my travels that's really blown my mind again and again, is how much it just brings home, no matter our culture or our language or how we're setting up our lives, these needs are really innate that we're born with. They're just, I always get to a place of not having verbal to describe it, because it's a funny thing. We're trying to connect about something that really is a nonverbal place, but the closest we can get to it is putting needs words on it to be able to name it so that we can make connection. When we were in Afghanistan, we brought this point home by having Jiva Mansky, Jesse Weens, and myself, and Nakme, our translator, sitting in a circle with a woman in her adult training, and we were teaching them empathy poker, which is a game where the needs cards go in the center and someone shares their story, and then people in the circle then offer needs cards to that person who's just shared their story and offers the needs, making their best guess of what's really alive in that story. So we had the woman who was sharing her story speak her native tribal language, which was not even Farsi or the languages that our translator knew. So this woman was speaking completely in a different language. And she shared her story for about 4 minutes. And then the four of us just connected, and then we pulled out the needs cards and placed them in front of her. And she just started to cry. She was blown away. She looked up, and she said, "Someone must have already told you my story." And we're like, "No, this is like connecting to that universal place is about connecting to the needs that are really alive in us." And I think that's one reason why I do love traveling all over, is because that's the common thread for me. That's the place I love to get to.
Wow, so the power of even without knowing the language, but somehow still connecting to really deep in the heart of whatever's happening. It's pretty amazing.
I love it. That's the juice that keeps me going.
Oh, yeah. And tell me about bridging the empathy gap. I know you were with me and sort of putting that forth. I'm wondering kind of about your new move out east and what all of that meant for you and where you're at.
Wow. Wow. It's so fun to try to think, where am I at right now? Well, I'm at three more boxes to be unpacked. Yeah, bridging the empathy gap was a fun project to jump into because of my excitement with the possibility with a new administration and with a president who's brought empathy into many of his speeches. That there's an idea that even our president would enjoy us to be connecting a little bit differently with each other is super exciting to me. So bridging the empathy gap this felt really natural to jump into, and I'm excited to see where it goes and if we can turn it into creating an empathy core of people that go out and just aren't afraid to just offer empathy in situations and scenarios. One thing Jesse and I want to start working on is creating a booklet and wristbands called Empathy First Responders. So to me, that's part of this empathy core idea is, you know, seeing if people want to get the training in empathy skills to just be willing to be the first one to respond in empathy. And kind of what put that idea over the top for me was I was in Maui this summer, and we were actually just going to go out to a movie, but we happened upon an accident in the road where a car had actually hit a young woman in the road. And Jiva actually said to me, Catherine, and pointed, because I actually also have medical skills. So I jumped out of the car and I went and, you know, looked at the woman who was on the ground, and then the paramedics came. And then I looked over and saw the couple who had been driving in the car that hit the girl, and I realized nobody was around them. And so Jesse and I walked over to them, and I walked right up to the man who had been driving the car, and I just looked at him and I said, I'm really guessing this wasn't in your plans today. And he just dropped into my arms crying. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed with them for at least an hour and a half, just offering empathy and being present and just giving our presence to them. And it was really interesting to me that there wasn't anybody else from the police or the paramedics coming over to connect with them. Until finally the police tape was going up because the girl had been called in as being in critical condition and it was now a crime scene. So the policeman came up and said, if you're not in the, you know, if you weren't involved in the accident, you'll need to leave now. And I kid you not, Sylvia, it just popped out of my mouth. I walked up to the policeman and stuck out my hand. I said, "Hi, I'm Catherine Cadden. I'm an empathy first responder. And I really want to make sure that these people's emotional state will be taken care of, as well as their physical state, because they're in a bit of shock after what's happened today." And he looked at me like, "Oh, thank you. Well, what do you mean?" And so I actually offered him a little empathy and then kind of bridged it over to the two people there. And they actually I saw the policeman just completely soften and really connect, and then he turned to the man and he's like, "Oh, well, let's make sure you guys get some food and you're taken care of." And And, you know, and then Jesse and I felt the relief of, you know, that there was people that were going to be able to connect to them on a human level, because we were really seeing how immediately right and wrong or blame thinking was coming in, because there was even people in the park that were yelling at the people that had hit them, that had hit the young girl. And so it's situations like these where, wouldn't it be amazing if everybody got the empathy they needed immediately in a crisis situation? I think that's where I'm really excited about seeing more and more people have the skills of empathy and kind of the courage and willingness to be the first to respond with it.
Yeah, I love that. Just a sense of, you know, seeing each other's humanness, even in those kind of situations where you're terrified and, like you said, you know, this probably wasn't in your plans today. It's likely not somebody's intention to physically hurt or harm or do something that's going to be stepping on someone else's needs in some way. So,
exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you had a lot of teaching there just in living those moments. It sounds like from the policeman to the people that got hit and then assisting the woman or the people who hit and the person who got hit. So
yeah.
pretty powerful example. And I love that empathy first responder. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're hoping also with bridging the empathy gap of getting with the empathy core, maybe having some empathy first responders with that.
Yeah, I would love to see that. It would be wonderful to see that there's people we could call in on in our communities or, you know, just for any situation. You know, when I was at the IIT, gosh, I think it was last December, the IIT in Albuquerque happens on a campus where there's also a high school. And we'd gotten word that that one of their seniors had died over the weekend in a car accident. And so I just went to the school counselor and I said, hi, there happens to be a whole bunch of people with skills in empathy, and I'm wondering if you'd like to have some grieving circles, and we have people who can facilitate. Would you like me to organize that? And he said, that would be amazing. And so when they reconvened for school on that Monday, I think it was that Monday, you know, I had actually asked a lot of fellow trainers who were at that IIT, Doug Dolstadt, John Kenyon, Jeeva Mansky, William Poner. We all went over, Celine, gosh, a whole bunch of us, quite a good troop I had there. And we went over and just created circles. So that the students would have an opportunity to be heard empathically and release their grief. And Jeeva and William and I ended up getting a chance to do a circle with the student who had been driving the car with the student in it who had died.
Yes.
And so it was wonderful. Immediately we got to do a role play. And I role played the kid that was killed in the car. And that boy had a chance to speak to me what was really happening inside of him and what was happening inside of him. He said, really articulately clear, he said, this is so hard for me. I actually feel joy I'm alive, but every time I feel that joy, I feel so much sadness and depression that you're dead. I don't know how to separate them.
Wow.
And, you know, and the counselor ended up sharing that it was just really amazing how fast the kids were able to get back into their classes
mm-hmm.
by having that. He'd been, you know, he'd been at the high school for years and seen other, you know, major traumas, and he was just really impressed with how the kids could integrate such a big trauma so quickly just simply by having these circles. And then it was really great. William and Jeeva got a chance to go a couple months later and do some follow-up circles.
So the power of empathy, really, just somebody, people having a place for that grief, like you said, a release for that grief is just crucial.
Yes, that's what I'd love to see in every community, you know, is that kind of resource that we can call upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Anything that you'd like me to know that I haven't yet asked you? Your connection to NBC, kind of, because I'm also thinking, you know, with Play in the Wild, that you, I'm guessing donations would be gladly received. So if anybody's inspired by what they're hearing, is there a place also that they might send some funds?
Yeah, if people are interested and inspired, they can, actually where we take our donations is at Jesse and I's other website, which is zenvc.org, zenvc.org. And we are mentioning the projects so people can name the specific projects that they'd like to donate to directly. We are working with Han for another trip to Afghanistan. And we are developing, we would like to really be able to offer Play in the Wild to any kid who's really curious and wants to attend. So we'd love to have scholarships available. So we definitely would love donations there. And then, and they can be updated by going to zenvc.org and even signing up for our newsletter there. And then they can be completely updated on all our projects.
Wonderful. And I know moving just out east, what are your hopes, passions at the moment that you want to fulfill in your new home, your new area?
Well, today it was about trying to get all my irises planted. I don't know if I've been out here long enough to really know exactly what that's wanting to create. I know I'd like to get involved locally, and one of the things we'd like to get going here is a prison project, being able to take NVC into the local prisons here and working with the inmates and with the guards that are here. So that's one local project we'd like to get going as soon as we can. And then also, you know, it's in my calling, and I can't stay away too long from schools and classrooms, so I would imagine that we'll end up working with some of the schools and the districts locally as well.
But what brought you out east was basically the change in administration, wanting to be closer to Washington. Anything else?
Yeah, wanting to be closer to Washington. We're definitely excited with working with the in D.C. with whatever might come alive there for projects. And we happen to be close to family. We're about 4 hours from Jesse's mom and his family up in Virginia, and then I have family down in South Carolina, and my parents have retired to Florida, and it's nice to be within driving distance now of all of them.
Nice. Yeah. Tell us, just in case the other recording didn't happen, I guess I'd love to just hear another moment about Play in the Wild, because it sounds like that's sort of a signature piece for you. And is that Jesse also that's working on that with you?
Yes, yeah.
So if you can just give the nutshell, and maybe we can go over the story again. That was really powerful about the woman on the trip.
Sure. Play in the Wild brings together, you know, my deepest loves of being out in the wilderness and nonviolence, the practice of nonviolence, and, you know, being able to take teens from their kind of normal situations or their, you know, what they're used to, and then placing them in a scenario out in the wild where, one, we've carried the food in on our back, so we have a limited amount of resource with us, and being in a situation where communication is going to be required to move through possibly just making a meal together with other people, or actually getting through, you know, a scenario of having to carry canoes across land, or get up mountains that are really steep and treacherous, or get over lakes, or, you know, whatever the wilderness or the terrain or the weather presents as an obstacle in and of itself. Out of that arises, how do we connect as a community, how do we problem solve in a way that connects us more deeply, creates more kindness and compassion, and brings alive each person's individual uniqueness and their special abilities that will actually make the group more productive.
And are these teens that generally really love nature, or they already have some connection to NBC?
I'm laughing because probably half the kids we get have never even been in nature. Mm. I would say that piece is, I would say it's like if a kid comes that's familiar with NBC, they may or may not have had an outdoor experience. And most of the kids we get haven't ever had an outdoor experience like this where you really are sleeping on the earth every night and you're subject to the weather and the conditions that will arise from the terrain, and that's what you're going to be meeting and dealing with. And then the kids come from all walks of life. You know, we've had kids that grew up, you know, with parents that, you know, got involved in NVC early on, or we've had kids that were from my school that wanted to go on the treks. And then we've had kids that simply referred to us either through a social work agency, or we've had kids that were on probation from juvie halls. We've had kids that just found us and thought it sounded interesting. So it's really fun to get, you know, a really beautiful, diverse mix of kids together into one scenario and then have them problem solve what it is to be community and not only help each other survive, but thrive, you know, for the time that they're together.
And are you sensing also these people stay connected after the trip and sort of form a longer-lasting relationship?
Yeah, we've had, it's interesting, there is a Play in the Wild MySpace, and I'm noticing the kids are getting a little bit more connected now. That's one of the, I guess that's an IT thing that is Jesse and William are working on about how kids can stay connected after they've been in a Play in the Wild experience. And we've now had enough kids come through that there's been requests for a level two. Can we do something a little bit more intense and something a little bit more deep and really training them to be leaders and go back and do projects in their community.
And so the age that you take, is it, because I know there's some family ones, is that right, with kids and families together?
We were contemplating doing that. We kind of put the idea out last summer, but then we let it go because our schedule got really full last year. So we haven't done that. You know, because of all the work I've done with my school, that seems pretty inevitable to work with the whole family. And it's still something I'm interested in doing. We're not going to be offering that this summer. But the kids have a chance to stay connected afterwards. I'm noticing more the Temba kids, the kids who attended my school, it's been some interesting things developing, particularly because there's a documentary film that's going to be coming out that's about the school and my work, and the filmmaker started going and interviewing these graduates, and through doing that found out, you know, where they are now and some of the things they're up to. But it was really funny, on Facebook I noticed there's actually developing a Temba club for anyone who ever attended Temba, and so now there's all these different kids from these different age groups, because the oldest Temba kids are now in their mid-20s, but they're connecting with kids who, you know, are still in high school and the kids who've gone through. And so it's interesting, they're kind of developing, even though some of them never even attended school together at Temba, this commonality of this has brought them together, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, and tell me about the film. How do we find out where we can see it and where it will be?
The film hopefully will be completed. That's something we're working on too, is finishing funds. Glenn Jansen's with Emotion Studios has been putting it together and is actually wanting to fund a finishing editor to complete the film, and then it looks like we have a possibility of being in the Sundance Festival, so that would be really exciting if the film can get there. I'm really excited about the possibility, not only just to tell the Temba story, but just to get more information about nonviolent communication out to mainstream audiences, maybe audiences that might not have heard about it before. So that's my excitement about the film. And when my book is completed that I'm working on, Peaceable Revolution Through Education, we'll be using some of the film footage and putting together a DVD that will actually come out with the book as well.
Exciting. And tell me, so Jesse, I know, is a partner in your life. How does he play, or how do you guys play together?
We play really well together. Jesse Waynes is not only my partner in life, but gosh, has become such a co-collaborator on so many projects. It's been such a sweet dance to learn how to... it's really fun to actually do trainings, particularly. We've created this one training called Dialogues of the Heart, and just kind of bring forward our own personal relationship, and, you know, we use ourselves as examples. We kind of put ourselves on the hot seat, and people seem to really like that. They like live examples of how partners talk about money or decision-making, and so that's been really fun for me to just, because I kind of like that really out there, honest way of teaching. And so we've been really developing quite a few things, and it turns out Jesse's also quite good with film work, so he's actually going to be assisting Gwen on some of the editing for the DVD and for the film.
Wow. And what was Jesse doing before he met you?
What was he doing before he met me? Well, he was living at the San Francisco Zen Center, and he had actually started Zen VC. He really wanted to bring together, you know, what he had learned through living at the Zen monastery and the teachings there, and what he had found to be so valuable in nonviolent communication. And I really love it. On one of his original business cards, he called it The Way with Words, how to bring alive this compassion and this way of being, but bring it alive with tangible words. And so that was his passion. He was already doing trainings of his own and kind of steeped really into it all himself. And then when we teamed up, it just was a really natural collaboration.
Very fun. Anything else you want to tell me that I haven't asked?
I have a really big, beautiful dog named Tosh. He's over 100 pounds. He's a big German Shepherd, and I just love him.
And how is he adjusting to the new life in the East?
He's doing great. He made a little dog friend nearby named Maya, and they play really well together. And he's so funny because I think he just lived with too many NVCers or something, but he really responds to verbal empathy. Like, I mean, like, if you actually use formal giraffe with him, he actually speaks back and goes, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, he'll actually get into conversation with you. It's really quite funny.
I think they're some of our best teachers, animals.
I agree.
Especially NVC teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Catherine. It's been a blast. And just one of the things that gives me a lot of joy, not only interviewing and hearing people's stories, but kind of knowing what your passions are and being able to share people's work and contributions so that other people really know what we're all doing in the network.
Yeah. I think it's a fabulous idea. And I just like the idea that it's kind of building community and, you know, just, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, not collaboration, but like a sense of companionship or camaraderie, or just, I like knowing. I'm excited to hear some of the other interviews.
Yeah, what we're all doing, what we're all about, what gives us juice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that you're doing it, Sylvia.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. All right, dear. Hope to connect again soon.
Yes.
Take care.
Thanks, Sylvia.
Thank you. Bye-bye.